And welcome back to A Book A Day podcast. In the previous two episodes, we were discussing Pankaj Mishra's book, Temptations of the West, where I talked about the author's journey in Pakistan and Afghanistan, which was in early 2000s. So it was quite interesting how the social and political landscape has changed. And yet, it hasn't. And in this episode, we will see what the author saw in India when he traveled here in the early 2000s. And the interesting part is when he goes to Bollywood. So, the next few passages that I'm going to narrate from the book, you'll find out what happens there when Pankaj Mishra goes to Bollywood and the kind of things he discovers there. So let's start, and I hope you'll enjoy this. Bollywood, India Shining. In Bombay in December 2003, I met Mahesh Bhatt, one of India's most famous and successful filmmakers. He told me, Bollywood is part of what our culture has become. We are lying to ourselves all the time. It wasn't what I expected to hear from Mahesh when I emailed him from London explaining that I wanted to explore the world of Bombay films or Bollywood and requesting an interview. I had seen and liked some of his 40-odd films, the autobiographical ones about his illegitimate birth, his unhappy childhood with his Muslim mother, and his extramarital affair with a mentally ill actress that had made his reputation in the 1980s. Though he had stopped directing films 5 years earlier, he still wrote screenplays and supervised his daughter's and brother's production companies. He had published a book about his philosopher friend, U.G. Krishnamurti. He made documentaries, but was also increasingly known for his denunciations in the press and on television of Hindu nationalists, sexual Puritans, and U.S. foreign policy. I saw him often on television, where he was a striking figure in his loose black shirt, which set off the white hair remaining on his shiny pate. I had once seen him shout during a debate where he said, I insist on my right to watch pornography, mark my words, he said on another occasion. Hindu fundamentalism will destroy this nation. More recently, he had turned down an invitation to a breakfast prayer meeting at the White House and described George W. Bush as the worst villain in the world. Drama was clearly important to Mahesh. My God died young, he told me, and then went on to describe how, angered by a God who kept apart his Muslim mother and Hindu Brahmin father, he had one day immersed his small statue of Ganesha in the Arabian Sea of Bombay. When I first met him in Bombay on the set of Murder, a film he had written for his brother, he had just returned from his visit to Pakistan. It had been, he said, a profound emotional experience. Though only 55 years old, he remembered his life as a long journey with clear-cut stages. In his 20s, he had taken a lot of LSD and gone shopping in the spiritual supermarket. In his 30s, when he finally made it as a filmmaker, he had come to know a great inner emptiness, feeling only sadness as his fax machine spun out box office figures from across India. It was in Los Angeles, the capital of materialism, that he had decided to renounce the pursuit of success. He had rejected his one-time guru Osho Rajneesh by flushing his rosary beads down the toilet. He spoke with passion and conviction, and I didn't feel I could ask him if the water pressure in his Bombay toilet had been strong enough to flush away the beads. His outspoken views had made him unpopular in Bollywood. He's a self-publicist, one film journalist told me. Ask him why he helps his brother and daughter make B-grade films, or why he rips off Hollywood plots for his scripts. But Mahesh was frank about his own work. I have made a lot of trashy films, recycling old formulas, which is what Bollywood does most of the time. I guess one has to keep working. He said he regarded filmmaking without illusions as a business like any other. Don't wait for the ideal offer. There's no such thing, he told a young actor, a part-time model with a gym-torn body who had come to seek his advice. What will you do at home anyway apart from bodybuilding? After the actor left, he turned back to me. These young people probably want to hear something else. They come to me, they think I'm in the business doing a lot of work and will encourage them. But I cannot make Bollywood bigger than it is. He said that his own films, even those that had made him rich and famous, had left deeply unfulfilled. He added, but I know that there is no fulfillment awaiting me anywhere. My friend U.G. Krishnamurti says that there is no other reality apart from the one you live with every day. There seemed something too neat and packaged about Mahesh's self-awareness. But while in Bombay, I found myself traveling often to his office in the suburb of Juhu. I walked straight past the reception to his small room, where I usually found him lying on a long sofa under a broad window with a view of shanties cowering under grimy buildings. Two mobile phones rested on his ample stomach. One of them rang more often than the other. But Mahesh picked up both at the sound and then, raising his neck from the sofa, squinted at the screens for what seemed a long time before deciding to answer. He was brusque on the phone, except to his wife and daughter. Who is this? He would often ask and then start repeating bye, bye, bye in rapid succession before ending the conversation. The door opened to admit Nirmal, his personal attendant, with one tea and coffee, or some of the young, trendy people working at the office. Occasionally, there would be someone Mahesh had arranged to see. A Pakistani actress hoping to work in Bollywood, a Parsi musician and ballet dancer wishing to try her hand at films, a tall, arrogant-looking actor wearing a Superman shirt, who, I learned, was the grandson of a notorious Bombay politician and had acted in Murder. Soni, Mahesh's wife, came once, a petite, shy woman. She had acted in many art house films in the 80s and was now trying to direct a film. The door opened less often for the aspiring actors, directors, musicians, distributors, and publicists who waited at reception hoping to waylay Mahesh or his brother Mukesh. They grew animated as Mahesh emerged from his room. A couple of them often trailed him with pleading voices all the way to the building's compound and spoke rapidly and uninterruptedly until he got into his car. There were more young men at the gate to the walled compound. I saw them every day chatting with the chowkidar and the drivers of the cars parked inside, breaking off only to gaze expectantly into cars entering into the compound. Muhammad, the driver of my hired car, said that they were aspirers who had traveled to Bombay from various parts of India, hoping for a break in Bollywood. They were often found outside producers' offices, waiting to catch the attention of the important or powerful people there. This was how most people tried to gain a foothold in what was a very crowded and self-contained world. India produces more films annually than any other country. Up to 1,000 in several Indian languages, made in Bombay as well as Madras, Hyderabad, Trivandrum, and Calcutta. Bombay, or Bollywood, is the biggest and best known of the Indian film industries and has the biggest audience, releasing up to 200 films per year. It faces little competition from Hollywood, which has never garnered more than 6% of the film market in India. In 1896, the Lumiere brothers brought moving images to India, shortly after introducing them to Europe. The first Indian feature film was released in 1913 in Bombay. By the 1930s, a film industry of sorts was in place in Bombay, with studios and independent production companies and stars, and films that borrowed or adopted narrative styles as varied as village folk theatre, Victorian fiction, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and Hollywood comedies and melodramas. The film industries in India now employ up to 6 million people, mostly on a contractual basis. There are 12,000 cinema theatres in India with an average capacity of 700 seats, priced anywhere between 30 cents and $3. Since the finance for films comes from outside the legal economy, no one knows what the actual turnover of Bollywood is or of any other film industry in India. Films are often made for less than $1 million, although some of Bollywood's recent films have cost as much as $30 million. Much of the money is spent on music composers, shooting stints in Europe and America, and the stars who are now more powerful than anyone else in the business. Not surprisingly, most of the aspirers wanted to be stars, not technicians. Occasionally, one of them succeeded and gave fresh currency to the dream of success. Mallika, a young actress I met at Mahesh's office, was an aspirer when 2 years ago she left her conservative family in a small town near Delhi in order to seek a career in Bollywood. Long queues of gorgeous women, she said, preceded her at every producer's office she went to. After a few modeling assignments and casting couch offers, she had finally found some decent work. But then her father ostracized her after her first film, in which she kissed the male lead 17 times, a record of sorts in prudish Bollywood. Mallika thought that she was unlikely to respond well to her next film, Murder, in which she had played an adulterous wife. She said, "The film is very bold, although I hate the word. People abuse it so much in Bollywood, which is full of dishonest tight asses." How long are they going to show sex by bringing two flowers together on the screen? India has the second largest population in the world. Do they think it came about by bringing flowers together? I met Mallika at the end of what had been a long day of shooting for her. But she came into Mahesh's office looking very excited, wearing a small white t-shirt and low-slung blue jeans over very high heels. A preview, or what she called promo, of Murder had just begun to appear on many of India's film-based television channels. I had seen an unedited version of this promo at Mahesh's office earlier that afternoon, accompanied by a film broker. A rapid succession of scenes shot in India and Thailand showed Mallika being undressed by invisible hands, making love and walking provocatively on a beach, the camera firmly focused on her hips. The broker had pronounced the film very bold. It was likely to get an adult certificate from the censor board. But this did not much bother the distributors, who were convinced that Murder was going to be a big hit. Mallika said, "I have been getting lots of SMS about the promo. It is very hot. Lots of skin show. But you tell me, you must have seen lots of films in London. What's so bold about showing a housewife feeling passionate and saying she wants to make love? What is a bored housewife to do when she's feeling horny?" Mallika told me that filmmakers from South India constantly approached her, wishing to cast her in soft porn films. They appalled and depressed her, as did most filmmakers in Bollywood. She really wanted to work abroad in Europe or America, where real films were made. She spoke of the work of Pedro Almodovar and Roberto Rodriguez. As she spoke, she kept brushing back thick, wavy hair from her full-lipped oval face. On that Sunday evening, Mahesh's office was deserted, with only a chowkidar waiting four floors down along with Mohammed, the driver of my hired car. Malika and I sat on a sofa, separated by a few inches, the narrow space into which she suddenly dropped, while still speaking of Almodovar, two glossy photos. There were publicity stills from murder and showed her pouting in a bikini and sarong. When Malika asked me if I had seen the promo for murder, I had lied, mostly because I couldn't work up a response. But now the photos lay on the sofa, and as I looked at them, I felt Malika's eyes on my lowered face. She said, "I want you to look at them. I want you to tell me if men are going to drool over me or not in this film. I want you to give me an honest opinion." English in India can be a deceptive medium. Even when the language is used well, as it is by an elite minority among the country's 200 million strong middle class, the undertones can be confusing. Moods and gestures are hard to figure out. Irony and humor are often perceived but rarely intended. "You should meet Malika," Mahesh had said. "She is the next sex bomb of Bollywood. It would be an interesting story for you." Mahesh had many such stories for me, but although grateful, I wasn't always sure what he made of them or what his true relationship with Bollywood was. One evening, as we were leaving his office, Mahesh paused before entering his car and gestured to one of the young aspirers standing near the gate to the compound. The man Mahesh had signaled to was a tall, rather handsome man wearing a black bandana. He walked towards us, his broad shoulders stooped until he stood half bowed in a silent namaste before Mahesh. Mahesh said, "This is Pritham. He has been coming to my office every day for 8 years now, hoping to get a role in my films. I have often offered him money for the return fare to his town in Bengal, but he has always refused. Would you like to talk to him?" I felt Pritham lift his head slightly to look at me. I felt a small crowd at the gate watching us. I nodded. Mahesh told Pritham while slowly getting into his car, "Okay, be here at 2:30 tomorrow." Driving back to my hotel, Mohammed was frantic with curiosity. He knew about Pritham, who was apparently famous in these parts. He had indeed been coming to the office for 8 years, but had not managed to speak to Mahesh Sahib for the last three. And he had never gone up to his office. Was he now finally being given a break? I said I didn't know. When I arrived at the office the next day, late around 4, Pritham was standing with the drivers. As my car slid past the gate, his face appeared in the window. Half bent, he accompanied the car until it stopped and then held my door open. I saw his beseeching eyes and the sweat patches on his ironed blue shirt. I said I was sorry to be late. He didn't seem to understand. I said that I was sure Mahesh would call him soon. Upstairs, Mahesh was lying on his sofa, bubbling with news. He got up as I came through the door. He said he was traveling to Delhi the next day to see Sonia Gandhi. The Italian-born leader of both the Congress Party and the then opposition in the Indian Parliament. Some Muslim theologians had arranged the meeting. They felt that Mahesh was best placed to convey their frustration with the Congress's failure to fight the anti-Muslim program of the government. Mahesh said, "It is a sad reflection on our politics that they cannot find anyone to approach her except Mahesh Bhatt." He showed me a folder of photographs sent to him from the western Indian state of Gujarat. The pictures of Muslims attacked, some by Hindu policemen in recent months. Close-ups of bloody wounds on skulls, backs and legs or of shattered car windscreens, television sets and dressing table mirrors. Each photo had the date and time of the attack written on the back. The accompanying letter from a Muslim described how his daughter had been beaten like a dog. We talked about politics for a while. Mahesh's mobile phones kept ringing. A journalist wanted Mahesh's opinions on the Oscars. "To hell with the Oscars," he said. "I'm not interested in it. Bye bye bye." Another journalist asked about the film Mahesh planned to make about the real-life con man caught conspiring with the police commissioner of Bombay. His daughter called. Her first film was due for release. Mahesh said that she was very nervous about it. Nirmal then brought us fresh coffee in styrofoam cups. A publicist from Lucknow arrived. "An important man," Mahesh explained. He was there to talk about Mahesh's upcoming visit to North India. Around 5 or so, Mahesh told Nirmal to summon Pritham. Mahesh said, "He told me once that he had committed a murder. His uncle, I think. I think he wanted to impress me. I want to ask him about that." When Pritham came through the door, his face glistening with sweat, Mahesh said, pointing to the bathroom behind him, "Go and wash your face." Water dripped from his face and onto his shirt when he came out. Mahesh said, "Sit down." He looked awkward on the small high-backed chair, his long legs jutting out. Mahesh gestured towards me. "He's a writer wanting to know about Bollywood. What can you tell him?" This was how Mahesh introduced me to actors, producers, distributors, and others in the film industry, often exhorting them to take me behind the glossy surface of Bollywood and reveal its harder reality. As it turned out, Pritham couldn't tell me much about Bollywood. Partly because he had spent 8 years hoping that Mahesh would introduce him to the Bollywood. He hadn't gone to any other filmmaker convinced that Mahesh would give him his break. "Why do you think that?" Mahesh asked. Pritham smiled uncertainly, said in slow but precise English, "Because I know that in my heart, sir, I know that you will take me to the summit of success. I have believed this for the last 8 years, and I will believe this for the rest of my life." Mahesh said in Hindi, "But why did you tell me that you had killed your uncle?" Pritham wiped his mouth and leaned forward on his chair. "It is true, sir. I wanted to tell you that I can be very serious about anything, even murder. I only have to put my mind to it." He described how he had been provoked into murdering his uncle. He seemed to have worked on the story, which came out smoothly. His father had died when he was very young. Soon afterwards, his uncles had appropriated his mother's land and house. One of Pritham's uncles had been particularly vicious. Pritham had seen him repeatedly assault his mother. At 17, he had first thought of murdering him. He spent a year planning the murder before finally stabbing the uncle in question. As part of his meticulous preparation, he had left no clues for the police. They were still baffled by the murder. His mother, Pritham said, was a devi, a goddess. He couldn't bear anyone being cruel to her and wanted above all to look after her. Mahesh said, "In that case, what are you doing in Bollywood? You have come to the wrong place. You come to Mahesh Bhatt thinking he'll make you a star. Mahesh Bhatt here is telling you that you are chasing illusions, that you should go home and look after your mother. Do you want money for the train fare?" Pritham shook his head. "I want you to give me a chance, sir. I won't go home without having worked with you." Someone opened the door to announce that the publicist from Lucknow was leaving. Mahesh said to me in English, "Why don't you talk to Pritham while I meet the publicist in my brother's room?" Without Mahesh in the room, Pritham relaxed. I wanted to know where and how he had lived in Bombay. "For the last 8 years, he replied, looking distracted, slightly puzzled perhaps, by the bareness of the room he had wanted for so long to enter, that he lived like an ascetic, did not drink or smoke, and ate very little. He stole whatever money he needed." "How?" I asked. But Mahesh returned to his room just then, and Pritham produced a letter in Bengali from his mother. evidence, he said, of his mother's good heart. Mahesh asked him to translate it aloud. "My dear son," Pritham began slowly, his eyes darting from Mahesh's face to mine. "I have not heard from you for a long time, and you have not sent me any money. I don't worry much because I know that your faith in Mahesh Sahib will be rewarded one day." The letter spoke of her continued suffering at the hands of her greedy relatives. When it ended, Pritham looked up hopefully at Mahesh. One of Mahesh's phones rang just then. He picked both up and, while squinting at them, said to Pritham, "I think you should go home and help her." Pritham stayed on for a few more minutes, drinking tea, surveying the room, while Mahesh spoke on the phone. I was relieved when Mahesh told him as he left that he would try him out before the camera. Outside, Pritham immediately conveyed the news to the crowd of chauffeurs and aspirers. Mohammed was very pleased on his behalf. It was the kind of break he hoped for himself. I wondered later if Pritham had written the letter himself, just he had made up the story about the murder in order to impress Mahesh. In its extreme raw emotions, his story sounded too much like a Bollywood film. I did not suggest this to Mahesh, however. I wanted Pritham to have his break. Also, I knew a little about Mahesh's background, and he seemed unlikely to doubt a story just because it was too melodramatic. His own father, also a famous producer and director in his time, had lived with his Hindu wife while maintaining a Muslim mistress, Mahesh's mother, in another part of Bombay. He came irregularly to his second home and didn't stay long. As a child, Mahesh had spent many hours waiting for his father, and then, when he did not turn up, consoling his mother. Mahesh said, "My mother loved him intensely until her death. I always remained slightly in awe of this aloof man who would come and go away and who had such a hold over my mother. When she died a few years back, he came to our house chanting Hindu scriptures and holding Gangajal. He saw my mother's corpse and said, 'Put some sindoor in her hair.' She was always asking me, 'Put some sindoor in my hair. I want this done now.'" The extent of Mahesh's father's love for his mistress was made clear, Mahesh explained, when his father himself died. "I used to ask my mother, 'Where will his corpse go?' As it turned out, he had left explicit wishes that he be cremated in our part of town. My mother's sisters knew what this meant. He was publicly acknowledging his devotion to the woman who loved him. My aunts showed up to the cremation. I saw them whispering and stealing a fistful of ashes. I asked them what they had done with the ashes. They said they had sprinkled them over my mother's grave. They were wishing for some kind of union. Critics accused me of melodrama when I put some of my background in my film Zakhm. I felt with that gesture that I had made my peace with him. This is what melodrama does. It reconciles people. This is what the best Bollywood films achieve." My own memory of Bollywood films was different. As a child in small railway towns, and then as an undergraduate in Allahabad, I had watched them frequently. For weeks, I would gaze longingly at the posters suspended atop electricity poles or draped on the sides of the tonga that clattered down dusty, narrow streets with understocked shops and faded signboards, the drivers announcing through a megaphone the latest arrival at the local cinema. I was particularly struck by the posters of new films. They often featured men gnashing their teeth and pointing out sized guns at each other against a backdrop of exploding skyscrapers and women showing bare arms and sometimes, more daringly, legs. My parents did not allow me to watch these films, claiming that they were too violent. They spoke fondly of tragic or flamboyantly romantic male actors of a previous era: Dilip Kumar, Raj Kapoor, Guru Dutt, Devanand. They happily let me go to films from the 1950s and 60s, some of which enjoyed reruns in small town cinemas, and whose mostly melancholy songs leaking out of 100 transistors in our railway colony filled the long afternoons of my childhood. But I wasn't much interested in the stories where love timidly expressed was usually thwarted, worldly success proved an illusion, and whose songs rendered sweet the cruelest disappointment. Like many young men in India, and unknown to me also in Africa and the Middle East, I was fascinated by Amitabh Bachchan. Although I watched most of his films after I left home and was pursuing an undergraduate degree in Allahabad, Bachchan, a gawkily tall actor with a baritone voice, often played the role of a poor, resentful young man pitted against venal politicians, businessmen, and policemen. Women, apart from tearful mothers, played minor roles in his films and were often treated ungallantly. There was little in Bachchan's own background that hinted at political discontent. Before seeking a career in films in Bombay, he had held a well-paid corporate job in Calcutta. His father, a distinguished poet in Hindi, had friends among the Nehrus and the Gandhis. But on screen, Bachchan was the angry young man, and he spoke directly to an audience that was no longer moved by the gentle self-pity of the actors that my parents liked. For many Indians, there was much to be angry about in the 1970s and the 80s. Freedom from British rule in 1947 and the proclamations of socialism and democracy seemed to have benefited only a small minority of the country's population, mostly politicians, big businessmen, and civil servants, people who plundered the state-controlled economy and protected their power and privilege almost as fiercely as the British had once dealt with challenges from the natives. So I'll leave it at that, and I hope the rest of it, what happens next, and how he talks about the modern cinema. Although you have to remember, this is still early 2000s when he was writing these pages. Pankaj Mishra gives us a glimpse of how Bollywood has evolved and how the social political backgrounds of various parts of India, they have evolved. So I'm sure you'll have a good time reading his journey along these parts, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the kind of observations he makes along the way. So enjoy this book, Temptations of the West, and let me know your thoughts, how you found it, even the parts that you don't like. So let me know. And I'll see you, or catch you, the next time. Thank you very much for listening.